Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning. Aren't you fed up, just totally fed up with the snow?
Yeah, I did a little rhyme. And it said, yeah, mirror, mirror on the wall, when will this white stuff cease to fall?
Oh, that's very clever.
And, did you like that?
Yeah, the only good news about the whole thing is that we managed to escape for 6 days of this awful white stuff. We had a route of flight through Charlotte, North Carolina that got us to London. Our flight was even early. And coming back, we had a trouble-free journey as well until we got out of the taxi in front of our house and tried to figure out how to get in.
Yes.
nevertheless, a wonderful time was had by all in the City of London. And today we're going to bring you three places which are new to us. Next week we'll bring you two old friends. And then we're sneaking in a little bit of something different at the end of the program as well. But starting out, what could be a better place to start describing the current dining scene in London than to be at Decanter Magazine's Restaurant of the Year for 2010, just announced, and a 2008-2009 Restaurant of the Year, and a restaurant that placed fifth in the top restaurants in the whole of the country.
Yeah, he said he was amazed.
In Nepal not too long ago. And that's the new venture of a mad Irish chef called Richard Corrigan, who we caught up with at his new place.
Well, we finally caught up with Richard Corrigan, a renowned chef. It's really wonderful meeting you. Peter's met you before, but this is my first time.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You were in bed the last time, huh?
I was, yeah, not doing well. I guess every food critic ends up with the food poisoning one time or another. Now, you are an Irishman, born and bred.
Yeah, I am indeed, yeah. I was born in the middle of Ireland in a place called County Meath, out in the wild moors, really, part of the world. You know, when you talk about bugs and moorland and mist, that's exactly where I come from. I left Ireland at 17. I live in the Netherlands. Worked in London now for 23 years.
So why did you pick the Netherlands?
I did because
that was interesting.
Well, it's very interesting. A good friend of the family, very good friend of the family, is Dutch. And you have to excuse that. See that Blackberry chefs, yeah? you know what I mean? Not Black Forest chefs in my pocket. I left Ireland for the simple reason is there was a very good friend of the family who's Dutch. And I got the chance to go work in Amsterdam. And I thought, why not? It was an opportunity. But you have to remember, there's some very fine restaurants in the Netherlands. You know what I mean? You think of Dutch and you think of bitterballen and you think of North Sea shrimps and herrings and eels. And you know what I mean, really? I had an amazing time there. I really enjoyed my time there. Great. You know, it was a new experience, a different place. And then I came back to London after many years in 23, when I was 23. And, you know, I went on the tour of the London hotel and restaurant scene.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about what restaurants are you involved with right now?
Well, I own two restaurants in London. I own Bentley's Seafood Restaurant in Piccadilly, which is a real British institution. It's been there since 1916. I was the head chef there around 20 years ago.
Oh, wow.
When the chairman of another company hired me to be the chef there, Mr. Cassidy. And I always looked on the place quite fondly. It came up for sale around five and a half years ago. And I jumped, pounced on it, really, because I knew what it was about, Bentley's. I knew what it should become. It's a tavern. It's quite unusual. It's not about chef's ego. It's about great, fresh food, simply prepared and served. And it's been a brilliant, stonking success. Really has allowed me to do an awful lot in my company.
You have another one too.
Yeah, we have Corrigan's in Upper Grosvenor Street. Lindsay House in Soho, which was a legendary Lindsay House, closed last year. The lease was up. It's, you know, I bought into a back end of a lease and I was on a full repair lease, so I rebuilt it. I paid up all my creditors and debtors and I closed it down and walked away and opened Corrigan's in Upper Grosvenor Street, which is much different from Soho. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Really, back end streets, slightly seedy. You know what I mean? And the only reason I opened there, because it was cheap.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Nobody else wanted it. Like, that's how restaurants open and evolve. They've always, the first restaurant of any chef is always in a bad area. And you, if it works there and you work hard, then you can, it allows you to move on in maybe 10 or 15 years' time.
Yeah, or you bring the whole neighborhood up.
You bring the whole neighborhood up. Yeah. I've worked very hard to bring that part of Soho up, but I failed, I'm afraid.
Well, now we're here now at Corrigan's Mayfair, and this is the flagship.
Corrigan's Mayfair is the flagship. I don't want to talk about uniqueness. I think it's going to evolve into a very special restaurant. You have to remember when we opened November of last year, and Lehman Brothers over the years had become Lindsay House's largest client.
Oh dear.
And the day I opened this restaurant, Lehman's went bust.
Wow.
Which was shock horror, frankly.
Oh,
because
I mean,
they had lots of business booked into this restaurant. I got very nervous. I phoned up a friend of mine at the time and said, should I charge for the food? That's how bad things were 1 year ago in the world. Yeah, it's quite extraordinary.
It's amazing how many restaurants opened in the midst of that.
Now, just quickly, listeners, just because the year just went around, and November you're talking about was November of 08.
Yeah, November of 08, yeah.
So you're now a little more than a year old.
We're over a year old, yeah, so it's now year 10, you know what I mean, 2010. And a year and a bit ago, when Lehman's went bust, I opened this restaurant on that day, and I thought, my God, this is very foolhardy and brave. And I initially, when I bought this site around 3-4 years ago, it's been a long project. It's been a huge project.
It was taking forever because we kept waiting for it to open.
Yeah, it was taking a long time. And initially, 3 years ago, it was in my dreams that it'd become this great, tenuous gourmet restaurant.
It's not. No, so tell us what it is.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. I've dropped all those little pre-courses and pre-starters and pre-desserts, all that nonsense. You look at the menu, it's with wine, it's about value, it's about nice craft. You know what I mean? We've got rid of all that, you know what I mean? So call it a brasserie of luxury. You know what I mean? That's what it would finely hold and crafted food. But we have the brasserie attitude here, you understand?
Yeah.
And I feel very happy where the restaurant will evolve too. It means we've survived the last year and a half. We're here. Yeah. Other restaurants have failed.
Richard, it sounds in many ways like Lindsay House used to be.
It's
almost like a reinvention of Lindsay House.
Yeah, well, it is. I think this is a modern reinvention of Lindsay House with all the, you know, without all the nappery and drappery. You know what I mean? We've get rid of all that. We had a Michelin star in Lindsay House for 14 years. Will Corrigan's Mayfair be a Michelin starred restaurant? I don't really know, I'll be honest with you, because I want to serve a portion of French fries on the side if you have a nice game plan.
That is my
attitude in life. Yes.
Fat fries, I want those.
Well, the French fries, I'll be honest with you, I cook in goose fat and they're delicious. You know,
oh,
so my feeling on food as I've got older has changed, and it's a bit of a reflection what the restaurant is. It's what I want to eat when I go to a restaurant, and that's what we have this place about. It's not just the ego in the kitchen. I mean, if you want a portion of spinach a la creme, I'll do it for you. It's on the menu, you know. Yeah. And I just feel it's a bit more grown up. We have a nice mixture of people coming here. You know what I mean? I have a lot of Americans because the American Embassy is just down the corner.
Just on the
corner here. And we're in Upper Grosvenor Street, there in Grosvenor Square. So we get a lot. We got the ambassador here quite often and a lot of embassy staff. So I really feel proud of that kind of American connection because they like it. They feel very relaxed here. You know what I mean? They don't feel like coming into another posh restaurant. They like to feel...
Well, that's what everybody wants now.
I think the world of gastronomy has changed.
Yes.
And I think it's changed for the next 10 years. What it becomes in another 10 years, I don't really know. But
right.
I think for this coming decade, we're in a more unpretentious environment.
You're right on it.
Really?
Yes. Now, it's not surprising coming from Ireland that you would be so concerned with ingredients, but you are. That's the basis of your cooking style.
Right? From the butter you have on the table, which comes from the Ripple Valley up in Lincolnshire, which is made for us every day, to the bread, to the homemade bread. We make our bread twice a day in the kitchen here. I'm a great believer in when the cooks smell home baking, they feel very, very, very personal about what they're doing. So much comes out of boxes. So much comes in pre-prepared. And you have to excuse my... it just shows you how busy I have become since you last interviewed me. You know what I mean?
You see
Email
busy.
City, yeah. I think my feeling here for Corrigan's is that it's a non-pretentious eatery, great food, wonderfully sourced, the impeccable sourcing that was always historic in Lindsay. And that's really what it's about for me. It's about handmade butter. It's about beautiful organics and above. Our wine list is organics and biodynamics mostly.
Oh, that's big.
And Lindsay House was a 4 liter in all of this. You know what I mean? Really,
yeah.
We had gone organic. I'm not joking you. 10 years ago, we'd gone there. More, 12 years ago. It was a movement that we've seen coming. And I think, you know, when you set your goal, you set your standard of what you want to do in life. You know, you have to stick to it. And sometimes, you know, I collect English portraiture, for example. It was deeply unfashionable 15 years ago to be collecting
portraiture.
Deeply unfashionable. And after all everything, it's It's coming good. Hey, Portugal is coming good again. You know what I mean? So I just think it's stick with what you know and do it really well. And if someone has a bad time, sort it out really quickly and move on.
That's
in
a
life.
Good point, yeah.
But that's what happens.
Now, you know, from your menu today, what are you going to recommend that we eat?
I'm not going to recommend anything. Oh. I want you to order and to eat and to enjoy. This is not about me telling you how to eat or what to eat. Corrigan's is about you choosing what you want with what you want to drink on the side.
Okay, well, let me pick a dish then, and you talk to us about that dish. Where was it I saw the rabbit?
The rabbit.
Saddle of wild rabbit.
Saddle of wild rabbit. It's a delicious dish, I'll be honest with you. It's almost like a little Ballantine. Very nicely roasted on the moment. It's gently stuffed. You see, served with the carrots and the pea shoots. It's very simple. But with the work that goes into it, it's finely crafted as well. But it's not overly reduced, heavy saucing. It's just nice food. I think the portions you will see is appropriate to what you want for lunch as well. I'm trying to get away from sticky, sticky, over-crafted food. We want something a bit more lighter, a little bit more expression in it as well. That you don't feel completely wrecked after your meal.
Yeah.
That you can't move.
How about octopus carpaccio?
The little octopus, it's cleaned, it's braised, and it's braised in juices of the veal. And then it's wrapped in the muslin and lightly poached in the veal stock. And then it's pressed again, cools down, it all solidifies itself. And then we slice it paper thin. And it's wonderful with some oranges, and we were serving it with some almonds. And last week we had it with a little bit of curd cheese. It's a wonderful light starter, you feel good, it's cool. It's popular with the ladies, there's no question about that.
And then you've got wood pigeon on pastry.
The wood pigeon and the pastry baked on the moment is delicious. It's a nice little lunchy menu. Chef is just wrapping them up in there at the moment. It looks like a nice spring roll. But great, you know, we've 60, 70 lunches today. I think we've had 60-something lunches, which is incredible. I mean, Lindsay House, for example, in Soho, we never done more than 15 lunches. And all of a sudden, you know, it's Wednesday in London, which is not a great day, but, you know, we're fullish, you know what I mean? Which we're full, nearly full, which I think that's brilliant. But especially on the street where we are as well, you know, we're just slightly off the beaten track. But in a very posh part of London, Mayfair is a different world.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Good shops.
Great shops.
So, and okay, so you have your hands full now. You're busy. You're hard to pin down. So are you going to just concentrate on working on the restaurants that you have?
Well, there'll be no more Corrigan's as far as I'm concerned. This is one where I'm going to put a lot of energy. We're evolving. We're only evolving. You know what I mean? We're only evolving. I want a busy, nice restaurant where people can feel a neighborhood restaurant where it's beautifully crafted, simple food. I'd like it full. I want it busy. But there'll be only ever one Corrigan's. This is never going to be more than this. Bentley's, on the other hand, Bentley's at Piccadilly. You know, we opened a Bentley's in Dublin last year as well. The day recession was announced in Dublin a year and a half ago is the day I opened. So we opened two restaurants in recession.
You're lucky.
Let's see, will Dublin be there in a year and a half time? But we'll see. It's going through a very tough time, my hometown, my home country as well. So, but you know what? When there's ups, there's downs, and there's always ups again. I'm a very optimistic individual. I'm a great believer in the American system. You know what I mean? Everything corrects itself. Customer always gets better value during this time. There's a bigger hello, a bigger goodbye. And restaurateurs and chefs really appreciate the customers during when there's downturns. It's a time for the customer to be king.
Well, I'm going to enjoy being queen, at least.
Thank you very much.
And thank you so much. Well,
thank you.
Hold on a second. We can't let Richard go without acknowledging that the dining community and the press have bought into your formula as well.
Yeah.
I read just about 2 weeks ago, the Decanter magazine, one of my favorite reads, voted Corrigan's Mayfair
the restaurant of the year 2010.
I guess it was for last year, 2009.
No, it was 2010. It was this January. Yeah. It was this January.
And then there was another award that
we got, the AA 2010 award, London Restaurant of the Year. And we got the Restaurant Association's top 5 restaurants, top 100 restaurants in the UK. We came in at number 5. So it's quite extraordinary. I was completely shocked. We had Adrian Farrar from El Bulli there as guest and that. And I thought I was going along for the evening because, frankly, I'll be honest with you, I didn't even want to be in the top bloody 20. I don't care. I'm too old. That when somebody said Corrigan's number 5, I had to have a slug of champagne. I was so shocked, to be honest with you. So, you know, the number crunching of where you are in the picking order of restaurants in life. It's always a hard one. But you know what? I'm very pleased. I put a lot of effort into the restaurant business over the last 30 years. And sometimes it comes good and it goes bad for some people. But, you know, we're very passionate with this. I love people in general. I try to put wrongs right very quickly, which a lot of restaurants kind of fail at.
That's a key.
I'll be honest with you. I don't send letters back saying, well, I don't think it was our thing. I won't. Listen, sorry you had bad experience. Come back as my guest. Thank you very much. Move on. And you know what? You never lose customers when you have that attitude. Say, hands up. Listen, we're a people industry. When it goes wrong, it goes wrong, believe you me. And from the reception having a bad day, to the waiter having a bad day, to the chef that shouted at the waiter last night and he comes in with a bad mood, and the customer gets it. So I'm a great believer in the optimism of our community, you know what I mean, keeping it great, keeping it good. And we're getting more efficient as well, we're getting better, we're looking at our business in a much different way. Because it is a business, the restaurant business, it's not the most easiest way to lose fortune.
Yeah.
It really, really is. So you have to look at it with an analytical mind, you start have to analyse things, you know, how are we doing good enough. We're putting a kind of American approach into, you know, how we look at things and reservations. Yeah sometimes we don't get it right, but you know what, overall we try hard, and that's what forms the difference of people. Like, we keep trying to be better.
Do you spend a lot of time in New York looking at...
No, I was trying to get to New York in January, but the whole snow situation in London wiped that out. London froze down for 10 days. But no, I like going to New York. I really do. I like going to see how things happen in New York. I mean, an American welcome in New York is good for New York. It's not necessarily good for London. Because in Europe, people look at hospitality that a little bit differently. You have to observe in both places what's good for there, and it's not necessarily good for London. But you see concepts, you see restaurants, you see, you know, Danny Myers, you see how he's built his business, and how he runs his business, and how he copes with his business. And people like that are good inspirations for us all. You know,
he's
people
a great
like that.
Guy,
yeah, he is a great guy, and I don't know him, but I'd like to get to know him. I'd like to meet him someday. And
he's just wonderful.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I just think people like Danny, you know what I mean, really, I'm the cook. The restaurateurs, we're certainly probably more passionate, more cooks. But Danny, very good at the systems and how you look after guests. And I think that's, you know, the standout people in the next decade is the people who achieve certain standards of looking after your customer.
Well, Richard, what a pleasure to talk to you. And now we're getting ready for the real business of the day, which is a lunchtime dining adventure. And listeners, you got to have this place on the list of places that you go in London for sure. Richard, thank you so much for talking
thank
to us.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thanks.
Very warm. Thank
Great
you.
Meeting. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're still in London. One wouldn't wish.
Well, we should just go back a second and note, since we talked with Chef Richard Corrigan before lunch, the luncheon was quite magnificent, and we said hello from Peter to an old friend, from Anne to a new friend, Christopher McGowan, who is the chef. Now, chef
talented
de cuisine,
guy.
I guess,
really
at
talented,
Corrigan's
guy.
Mayfair, having previously been the chef at Corrigan's at Lindsay House.
And who was also dining at lunch, dear?
Well, they said the Duke and Duchess of Westminster who own...
No, I beg your pardon,
the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire.
Devonshire, and they were right there.
Who used to own Chatsworth House in Derbyshire, a wonderful place.
It's a gorgeous place.
And still own a considerable amount of the City of London. I guess they must live nearby, and the nice part about it is that everybody just left them alone to have their lunch. But
Anne
just wanted to sneak this in, that we were dining with the oi polloi,
like,
as it were.
I'd like to sneak in something. I mean, you don't want me to talk today for some reason.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, and then they just had this article in the paper about how the Duchess is very, very strict about manners, and one that does not discuss sex, money, or bodily functions with her.
I'm sure we were just jumping up and down, ready to do that. Anyway, let's go on, because our next port of call is a fascinating multi-use travel food and hospitality product called Boundary.
And this exceeded all my expectations, I must say.
And you'll find out about it all if we play the interview, won't they?
On the Menu is at a place called The Boundary, in London, of course, but I'm going to actually have Owner General Director Peter Prescott tell us about this property? Because it's more than just boundary as a single place. It's a complex. Peter, welcome to On the Menu. Please tell us where we are. What kind of place is this?
Okay, well, welcome. We are in Shoreditch, which is on the corner of East London and the City Fringe. A very exciting, creative area.
Which is spelt differently from what it sounds.
It is spelt differently, yes. It's a creative part of London with lots of advertising agencies, architects, designers, graphic designers. And we've arrived and we've got here three restaurants. One of the restaurants we're in now, Boundary Restaurant, which is the centerpiece. It includes the small bar at the entrance of the restaurant, 124
very
seats.
Smart small bar.
Smart. My business partner, Terence Conran, calls it the erotic bar.
Because of the photographs.
Because of the photographs, yeah. So, and then we've got a 124-seat restaurant that's open 7 days a week, lunch and dinner. And then on the ground floor, we've got our simple British cafe called Albion, which includes a small bakery and a food store. Sandwiched in between the Albion and the top floor restaurants, we've got 17 hotel bedrooms. They're all completely different designs, following design movements or designers such as Sir David Tang or indeed Terence Conran's personal preferences. Or they may be in homage to people like Andre Putman or Le Corbusier. And then, as I say, on the top floor, we've got Boundary Rooftop Restaurant Bar and Grill, which is basically a Mediterranean grill restaurant that's only open over the summer months, which in London...
And that's a pretty gutsy thing to do in London.
Having a rooftop restaurant is a gutsy thing to do, yes. But it's a big complex. We've got 33,000 square feet here, and we've got a range of reasons why people might come and visit us, from breakfast in Albion Cafe to a drink on the rooftop in the height of summer to a really lovely romantic meal on a Saturday night here in the restaurant.
Tell us just a little bit about this background, the background of Sir Terence Conran. I mean, his name is everywhere, and so are his properties. And you've been in business with him for a long time.
I've been in business with him for a few years. And then before I was in business with him, I worked for him as one of his directors of the restaurant company. But Terence Conran, as a person, as a restaurateur, he's done everything. This was his 50th restaurant that he's opened. We've opened another restaurant since, his 51st restaurant over in Fleet Street in the other part of London, in the city. But somebody who's opened 50 restaurants, well, that says it all, really. But he's also been running retail businesses, a big string of retail businesses, other hotels, graphic design industries, product design, architecture design. Yeah, he's done everything in the restaurant world. A range of different food styles, from simple French to gourmet French to Spanish restaurants to tapas bars. He's done it all, sushi restaurants. And so his passion really is about the food, high-quality food, but he happens to be a designer. So he's married the two together, designing a great restaurant and a great hotel, in this case, together with great food.
Now, your background, how did you get involved with all this?
Well, I started in hotels, and I worked in the pretty formal restaurants and hotels such as Claridge's and the Connaught and Grosvenor House. So I worked my way up through the hotel side of things in the classic days, in the sort of classic hotel kitchens and the classic hotel restaurants. And then I took a move to work as the general manager of the Royal Opera House before it reopened.
Did you really?
Yeah, I worked in the Opera House. I did everything except what goes on the stage. So I was looking after the restaurants, the cafes and the bars.
So you're a pretty creative person yourself.
I'm reasonably creative, yes, but I'm the person who runs it all. I think my side of the business is Terence principally comes up with the ideas and the creative elements. I share his vision and understand it and help him deliver it. So I'm running the company from the operational side, front of house, to the back of house financial side. I do all the business planning. I do all the recruitment, build all the teams, and then look after the businesses day to day. And Terence is just brimming with ideas.
Oh, doesn't he?
So Terence is off thinking about the next one.
He's constantly thinking about the next one, always thinking about the next one. And he's thinking about the next menu, and he's thinking about the next chair he's going to design for the next restaurant. And he's thinking about, I was talking to him the other day, and he's thinking about the new lampshades that he's going to be designing. And he's thinking about the new decorative pieces for the restaurant tables. So he's always thinking about those things. I like to think I'm thinking about them as well. But day to day, I'm running the restaurant, and I'm talking to all of the staff, and I'm, you know, making sure that we're delivering what we say we want to deliver on the menus and so on.
Now, a lot of your properties are unusual pieces of real estate when they start out, and this one isn't any different. Can you fill us in a little bit on the history of the building and why you thought you could do with it what you did?
Well, firstly, we look for interesting spaces, interesting architecture, interesting history, interesting building components. Once we feel as though it's got something of a character, the creative process starts. We then start to look if it's got a particular history in a particular area, then we may link to that. We may actually do something completely opposite, but just find the setting really interesting, whether it be the materials, as I say, or what the previous use of the building was. And then once we've got over that stage, found the interesting property, secured the property, done a little bit of financial planning, we then start to work on what sort of menu we're going to have, what sort of parameters, what sort of style of things. And then what comes next is the menu. In fact, actually, before we get into the detailed business plan, we then sit down and decide, right, what's going to be on the menu? And now this may be 2, 3, 4 years before we actually open. We then start to say, right, we're going to have some snails, we're going to have some Chateaubriand.
Oh, wow, and we that's start amazing.
That's how it starts to come to life. And then we start to build up. Now, do we want this to be a comfortable restaurant, or do we want it to be a sort of restaurant with or without linen? That's how the process starts. In the case of this building, well, we've seen the building, we fell in love with it, Terence in particular, and some of the architecture and some of the Victorian detailing. And that's a theme that maybe you might see at some of Terence's other buildings, you know, this light Victorian industry. He likes to work with that and then juxtapose the fine linen and glassware and silver alongside the sort of coarseness or the rugged architecture. And that's, as I say, it's a Conran theme. Old, traditional, Victorian against modern, smart,
and
clean.
That's in the rooms, too.
You can see that in the bedrooms. You can see it. Even though Albion, our cafe, is quite traditional, there's modern touches. But what we're trying to do is, if something is traditional, if we can call it that, but it works, and it's a good piece of craftsmanship, we think it'll work in a modern setting. And it may even still appear to be very modern if it's been well made and it's craftsmanship. Then I think that's probably a hallmark of Terence's design work and how we'd like to think this company is.
This brickwork in this room is extraordinary. I mean, the arches, the coins on the columns, I mean, really beautiful stuff.
Yeah, it works quite well alongside things like the wood paneling and the lighting details. And this floor was a real labor for Terence, you know, creating this tumbling block floor and finding the French marble, making sure that the grade is right, making sure the color scheme is right.
It looks really expensive.
Believe me, it is really expensive. It is really expensive. And what goes underneath it was really expensive. In the case of this restaurant, we had to strip back 3 meters from what you see the surface now and put in a whole new underground drainage system. Because it was light industry and it was not equipped for a restaurant where you need special drains and you need to all sorts of different water supply systems and so on and gas supply, we had to strip back the whole of the floor. It was a big construction job, and then put in all the new piping. And as I say, we're working with an old Victorian building here, so it's quite a task.
Now, who comes here, Peter?
Well,
who comes at different meal times?
I was going to say that the key thing about this building is we've got so many different reasons to visit, whether it's breakfast or drinks in the evening, as I say, and therefore, because there's so many different options, we get such a diverse crowd. However, I'd probably say the slightly more dominant group is people who work in the creative industries, who are working locally. We're quite close to the city, but we seem to be more focused on people who may be architects, designers, advertising agency people, creative people, young entrepreneurs as well, moving into retail. There's an exciting area of London for retail, different mixed retail. And those, I would say, are our core client base. People interested in art is also one of our core markets. We've got a very high density of art galleries in the area, small galleries, young galleries, and the people that run these galleries and the artists associated with them visit us a lot. And we see them in the morning for a breakfast meeting with a laptop and a coffee, and then we see them at lunchtime in the restaurant, and then we might see them in the bar early evening, and then they're all of a sudden talking to us, I've got this artist coming to stay with me, any chance we could put into a room, and then we see them in the next day all over again.
Amazing.
This would also have to be something of an adventure for a business visitor to London or a tourist visitor to London as well, because Shoreditch opens up the way to a very different part of London, not just in the immediate vicinity, but you can get to St. Paul's and you can get to Southwark, you can get to some parts of London that are far off the West End tourist track, can't you?
I would say that Shoreditch is quite some way from the West End tourist track.
Why don't you spell it, just because I mentioned it?
It's spelled Shoreditch. NCH.
See what I mean?
Shoreditch. It's just on the city. If you just ask for the northeast corner of the city, it's an area of London that was little known 10 years ago. It's now known as probably the most exciting area of London. It's certainly the part of London with the greatest amount of change. But the key thing about it here, about Shoreditch for an overseas visitor is that it's not yet established. What you can see is change. What you can see is the young industries coming up. What you can see is still some traditional food and drink markets and the young and new fresh markets. You can see fashion markets. And I'm talking about street markets here with street food as well alongside smart restaurants.
That's another good trend, yeah.
And then you can see new businesses coming into the area. And you can see all of a sudden this established old traditional artisanal ateliers, like next door we've got this upholstery shop and so on, alongside brand new businesses, established businesses. So it's an exciting area. You have to be careful in the area, you have to know where you're going, and I would urge anybody who's going to be travelling to Shoreditch to come by taxi.
Okay, we've been to places like this before, yeah.
There's plenty of taxis in the area, there's plenty of cabs available. But
and we did come by taxi.
Yeah, good. It's most certainly an interesting experience to travel by.
Now, what about a website while I'm thinking of it?
Our website address here is www.theboundary.co.uk.
Okay, .co.
.co.uk.
UK. Now, you have an open kitchen. I mean, totally open kitchen. It's great. It's all glassed in. And everybody's going about their little ballet of making food in there.
Well, we made them move their staff meal because they were going to eat it right next to where we are. And they're eating it in the kitchen instead. But we saw your wonderful homemade charcuterie display on a little trolley, which is a sort of a new idea. But what else is coming out of the kitchen, Peter?
Well, the food here is intended to be upscale, smart French brasserie food done in a skilled way. Not done in a tired and exhausted manner, but done in a high-quality ingredients, premium produce, done simply, not overwrought. I think that's a very important point.
Yeah, I agree with you.
We're not ashamed or embarrassed or worried about doing simple, renowned dishes, choucroute, confit de canard, lapin à la mouta, chateaubriand. We do simple things like that, but we'd like to do, when we don't do them with a twist, we do them how we think they should have been done in the very beginning, bouillabaisse. But we do simple things like we'll do oysters, we'll do, as you say, the charcuterie.
Escargot,
frog's legs. We have a fine selection of foie gras. On our next menu, we've got a Périgordine salad with foie gras and truffles. We've got a sauté de foie gras and a terrine de foie gras. So
it doesn't look very expensive, actually.
Well, the thing is about this location is we cannot rely on a population on our doorstep who are ready to throw lots of money at a lunch experience. We have to offer value for money. There's a lot of young restaurateurs out there in this area who are all keen to be successful. And if we start to overprice our restaurants, all of a sudden we'll have an empty restaurant. And we rate the atmosphere in the restaurant as highly as we rate the food quality. And we rate the food quality very high.
Well, I mean, it seems to be a very exciting place. It's a happy place by my standards. But then I love all this design.
It seems like we sat talking with Chef Ian Wolfe for about 30 minutes, just chatting about restaurants in town and what he was doing in his kitchen. And he just sounds like he's having a wonderful job. And he seems like he enjoys every single day. And Peter, you seem to too, and you told us you seem to spend quite a lot of your time here. This is your family. These are your wives and children.
That's very much the case. We're all a big family together. We're professional, but we all work together for long hours across the day. I would say that probably Ian and I are the two people here the longest hours of the day, and we're the two most senior people in the building. And normally Ian's in the kitchen 8 o'clock every morning, and he's when we're leaving at 11 p.m. in the evening, we're the last 2 hours. We're not the first two in because we've got our breakfast chefs here for that, but we're not far behind them, and we are here all day. And Ian is the sort of person that works all day. He doesn't go off for a break or whatever.
He also is the chef that, after my own heart, he doesn't eat junk food, which most chefs eat horrible food, fast food and junk food.
No, Ian is not into that at all.
He's really healthful.
He's a healthy guy and very balanced individual.
Yeah.
And he enjoys wine as much as he enjoys the food. And he's very often attending the wine tasting. We have wine tastings here almost every other day, whether they're with our own sommeliers and the staff or whether with the visiting merchants. Ian is part of that process. And, you know,
well, he's one of, you know, Peter's a great fan of Ian's from when he was at the Lead.
His previous restaurant, Almeida, I mean, that's the reason why he's here, because he did some great simple food there. And the charcuterie and the charcuterie trolley that he did there is one of those things we said, listen, if you're going to come to this restaurant, we want you to come with your charcuterie trolley. We want you to make those duck rillettes and rabbit rillettes and the jambon persier and all those lovely, lovely things that we like to see during the Campagna. What we like to think there is that it's simple French country lunch, but in a nice, smart setting. And that's what's a key part of the restaurant, alongside some things like Dover sole or turbot. You know, we've got, and I've mentioned the foie gras. So that's what this character, the character of the restaurant is about, and that's what Ian's character is about. So I'd like to think it's also mine as well.
Now, does he supervise the Brit food part of
Albion
as well? So this is a place for the full English breakfast?
Yep. Ian oversees...
Fish and chips and mushy peas and...
Absolutely. Ian oversees all of the food in the building. We work together on all the menus. Process on the menus is whether it be the rooftop restaurant where we do principally Mediterranean grill food or the breakfast menu or the supper menu in Albion or, as you say, the typical English English food in the cafe and the bread range even the shop range. We sit down and we talk about, right, okay, what's available in the seasons, what have we done before, what we really like, and we go through that process, we talk about it, then he'll go away and work with his chefs and invite ideas, talk to them about how it might work. We're fortunate now we're coming into our second year, so we can do, we're just doing January for the, we've just finished January for the, it's our second January, and that's quite exciting to do this, some things at the same time, and now we're just planning our February menu, so, or just working through early days of our February menu and our end of February menu and March menu, so for the second time, which is quite interesting. But yes, that's the way it works. Ian and I will work on the menus together, we come up with the ideas. But Ian is actually quite careful to talk with his own people and all the way down the range. And I'm talking about the commis chefs will be invited to chip in ideas. But they know that we're not going to go crazy. We're not going to go off-piste in a skiing term. But we like to keep within the framework.
Well, go ahead.
We're so glad we made the journey here. It's such a pleasure to meet you, Peter, and to look around. If you're of the mood for an unusual place to stay and business brings you to the City of London, this would be a great new adventure. In any event, it should be on your breakfasting, lunching or dining plans. The website again, Peter, is?
It's www.theboundary.co.uk.
And dress smart, because it's a smart place, not overdressed, not stuffy, but very, very chic.
Thank you for that. That's right. I want people to be here and be comfortable.
And comfortable.
Comfortable. So I think it's a smart, chic restaurant, but most importantly, come and feel comfortable.
You're wonderful, Peter. Great to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
And now it's time to take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and there we were again at another restaurant.
And Peter misspoke, because we have four new friends in today's program.
Right.
And, of course, Anne corrected me, and we quickly made the appropriate adjustment, because our next restaurateur, chef extraordinaire, was a really very remarkable young man. Mohammed, I won't try to do the rest of his name. Cooks a combination of Lebanese and Syrian with two partner chefs at a restaurant called Al Waha.
And it's generally described as Middle Eastern, but those are the primary influences.
And here's the story.
Just as Middle Eastern food has many, many levels and a great deal of depth, so does our interviewee for this segment. It's been a delight to meet you, Mohammed Badr Aldin Antabli?
That's correct. Yes.
Say it fast for our listeners.
Muhammad Badruddin Antabli.
Oh, see, that's great. The restaurant itself is called Al-Waha. And what is the section of London that we're in?
We are between Notting Hill Gate and Queensway or Bayswater.
Now, the name means something.
Yes.
And it's it
means oasis.
Oasis. And this been you were in another location in Piccadilly. It was also called the same?
It was the same name, yeah, the same restaurant, yeah.
So this has always been your restaurant?
Yes. We had different partners. When I was in Piccadilly, I had different partners from what I have at the moment, different chefs. But the name stays the same.
Now, you have such a complicated, very fascinating background. You weren't really intending to be a chef and a restaurateur, but circumstances prevailed, and circuitously, you came here. Tell us where you were born, when you left your country, where you traveled to, how you ended up in London, and how you ended up being a chef and a restaurateur.
I left my country in 76. I went to Lebanon.
You were born in Damascus.
I was born in Damascus, that's correct, sorry. Went to Lebanon, Beirut, stayed there for about 9 months, 1 year. Then visited north of Africa, like Algeria, Libya. Went to Spain, went to France. Eventually, I ended up here in London. I was hoping to study to become a film director.
He's very handsome, listeners. I know you can't see him, but he would make a wonderful, charismatic film director.
Well, I was hoping to do that because a friend of mine at the same time was studying in Poland, and I really wanted to do the same thing here in England, in London. When I came here, the fees for the school...
Now, his last name wasn't Polanski by any chance.
No. Well, my friend was studying in the same school.
Really?
In Poland, yeah. And at the moment, this friend of mine just happens to be that he's the head of the directors in the Syrian TV.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I couldn't do that because the fees increased year after year. It was Margaret Thatcher who was in charge in here, and they decided to put up the fees for the school. So every year I saved some money. The next year I found out that the money was a little bit more. So I kept saving for 2 or 3 years, and then at the end of it, I gave up. But during that time, I was working in a restaurant just to make some money on the side, like any other student. I started off, as I told you, as a pot boy, a washer up, cleaning like a porter.
Right.
Yeah, dishwasher. And then I realized that this job is very tiring. And in order to get rid of it, is that I had to learn something simpler, like cutting up a salad or washing up vegetables. And I did that. And the opportunity came when the guy who was in charge of that decided to leave, or he didn't come that day. And they promoted me. They said, could you come and do this job instead? And from that time, or from that day onwards, I kept learning other things. So I kept being promoted. And within 2 years, I learned the whole trade. I worked as a butcher.
Oh, my.
I worked as a chef on the grill. I worked as a baker. I worked, you know, for the mezze, like making hummus, mutabal, you know, these cold starters.
And then all of a sudden you got the best Middle Eastern food in London.
I didn't realize that I had a very good flair for it, but year after year I found myself that I'm really good at it.
I mean, was your family very involved with food?
My mother was, and my mother kept telling me tips and things like, you know, how you should do this and how you should do that. I never studied this. I never went to school. I didn't go to with any particular chef. I just really picked it up from different people over all these years.
And did you find suddenly that you loved it?
I love it at the moment, yeah. I definitely... There is something very satisfying in giving something really like a good dish, and you see people enjoying it, and you look at their faces and they are so happy. There is some beautiful things, I think, around all that, for me anyway.
And there are some people who would say that the restaurant business is theater anyhow, in
yes.
its own.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, because you see different people from different type of the society, from different classes, different nationalities. And it's wonderful to sit back and watch all these people and learn from them, learn how they behave at the table, different codes, different way of etiquette. You know, what is good for you is not good for them. Different sign language, like, for example, when they finish, they different people have different way of telling you that they have finished their meal by putting the forks in a different way and the knives.
Yeah, right,
you know?
This is true.
So everybody, it's wonderful.
And chefs, when it's time to go into service, frequently say, it's showtime.
It is showtime, indeed.
There's one thing I think, Liz, that we must emphasize, because this sounds a little bit like a fairy story, and the happy ending is that Muhammad has a little restaurant and lives happily ever after, but it's really not like that.
It isn't.
We came here today because a restaurant that we really enjoyed the last time we were in London, they said, have you been to Awaha? And I kept the note on the menu from that restaurant. It's called Magdalen, and it's near... between London Bridge and Tower Bridge, far away from here.
Yeah.
And yet they said, this is a great restaurant, you must go there.
Uh-huh.
And they're not the only ones, because I think you received some awards along the way too.
Yes. It's a very, very hard work. First, let me stress that. It's extremely hard work to be in any restaurant, let alone being in a restaurant which is one of the top from the point of view of Lebanese cuisine in London, I'm talking about. In fact, in 2006, we were nominated among the top 10 restaurants across the board by the Evening Standard. It is very difficult when you get to that stage. It's very difficult to keep maintaining the same standard. And anybody who thinks could make a lot of money just by being a restaurateur, forget it, because you could lose your money in no time if you don't know what you're doing. It is very demanding. I work on average of 12 to 14 hours a day. You have to be here. You have to make sure customers are happy. You have to make sure the ingredients you are getting is the right ones. You have to make sure that everybody in the kitchen is doing his job correctly. So it is not as easy as my... It's not a fairy tale.
Well, many of our listeners will know that Anne didn't lose a small fortune, but she certainly didn't make a small fortune either.
Sure, I didn't make a lot of money either.
In the restaurant business a long time ago, so I think we're very familiar. But you must have built a team behind you now.
Yes.
Of people are executing what you used to do.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've got two people who are extremely good. Those are two main people downstairs in the kitchen. One is Syrian, and the other one is Lebanese. And both of them have been with me since we started. So
now that's very good.
Yeah.
So you must be a very good boss as well.
Well, they are also my partners. That is the only way to keep good people, I think, with you, is that you give them incentive. Because I think it doesn't matter how much money you pay anybody. There would be a time where they would think that they need a change, either because they think that they could make more money somewhere else, or they might think that I could do that on my own, and they go on and start a new restaurant. Or somebody else might really pay them more money. So I think in order to keep the same team is you have to give them incentive. You have to share, to a certain extent, some of the profit you make with them, to show them that whatever they do has a reflection on them in terms of money at the end of the month.
Can you shape a Lebanese dining experience at Al-Waha for our listeners? Since you understand we're sitting at a table before dinner service, but already has arrived on the table what looks an awful lot like feta cheese and a bowl of delicious-looking black and green olives, and then a most unusual platter of vegetables.
Crudité.
Packed in ice, sitting right on our table, and fortunately, so far it hasn't flooded the PC which we're recording, but I'm watching carefully. So this would be a typical way on...
This is how you start. This is how you start in our food.
And
you have the crudité.
Take us along the way.
Yeah. While you are ordering, you eat some olives, some cheese. The crudité will come with your food, sometimes before your food, if you are ordering wine. And this is to get your palate going. And it has also another function. Because our food has a lot of mezze and a lot of different dishes, so when you start eating one particular mezze on one dish, if you want to move on to the other one, you clear your palate with a carrot or a lettuce or something else, and you move on to the other taste. So the way we eat is you eat one dish at a time. I know Europeans like to, generally speaking, people from the West put piles up a little bit of each dish on their plate. And I don't think this is really a good thing to do when you come to a restaurant like mine.
Now,
the food is there.
You call this Middle Eastern in general. You're not differentiating between Syrian and Lebanese food.
No, because Syria and Lebanon, really, the food is, I would say, from my point of view, is almost identical. Okay. There are slight variations here and there, but that depends on the region, whether you are from the south or from the north. Okay. There are a few things which they cook differently from us, yeah, and this, vice versa.
But
the essential ingredients, the essential foods, the main dishes are identical.
So there might be certain regional differences, but basically it's the same concept.
Oh, absolutely. And don't forget, I mean, that part of the world also, during the Ottoman Empire, it was all as one country. People were traveling between Syria and Lebanon and Palestine and Jordan and Iraq, all that area. People, there were no borders. People were more or less traveling freely. They had the same kind of food, the same kind of movement. So, and especially between Syria and Lebanon that
so
is
close,
the case.
Yes.
I mean, Lebanon was established after the First World War anyway. As a safe haven for the Christians,
right,
by the French.
Right, yeah, it was a creation that essentially echoed the creation three decades later of another country called Israel.
That's right.
So
in 48.
So the concept was already there. So we're going through the metzeh, which are small dishes.
Small plates,
what the Spanish would call tapas.
Yeah.
And then what are some of the typical main dishes that are characteristic?
The main dishes, it depends. I mean, we have a lot of main dishes from the grills, or you could have a lot of main dishes like bladijur, like dishes of the day, what we do, like the main cooking, if you would like. We have kusa mehshi, which is stuffed kujet with rice and lamb cooked in tomato sauce. You could have the meatballs cooked in tomato sauce, served with rice on the side. Those are the main cooking. As if you want to know from the grill, we have kofta. It's
kofta,
in fact, called kofta halabiyya, which means kofta from Aleppo. Halab is Aleppo, so you say kofta halabiyya. So that certainly is coming from Aleppo, although it's an Lebanese cuisine or Lebanese menu, but it shows the connection. You have also another dish called kibbeh shamiyya, which means the meatballs, the burgul, which is stuffed with minced lamb and pine nuts and onions deep fried. It's called kibbeh shamiyya, which means from Damascus or from that area. So, and so on.
How do you know what to order? There's so many different things on your menu, so many delicious things.
Well, it's always a challenge for somebody who comes in here on his own because there's so much you can eat.
So
I think our food is really tend to be as it is best when you have six people at the table, or eight. I think eight is the perfect number for me.
Eight.
Because then you could have as many starters as you could. Because if you order one starter, you could barely finish it on your own as a starter. Because it's quite you know, reasonable size. But if you come at eight, like, you could have maybe 16 or 20 different starters to share between you.
Yeah.
And I find that skipping the main course is a great idea. If you don't know anything about Lebanese food, you order three starters each. You pick up three starters each, and you share it.
We do that with Western menus all the time. The appetizers seem to be, the chefs seem to enjoy making them more.
Yes. And now the Western people and the Europeans are learning the idea of sharing, rather than this is my starter, this is your starter, this is my main course, this is your main course. I think the idea of sharing is beautiful, because not only you have more taste and you widen your horizon, but also it is from the human point of view that when you share somebody's food, you have more bond with each other, even sitting at the same table.
You know, this is such a serene environment. I didn't want to get away from you explaining to us these gorgeous pieces of framed calligraphy on the wall. I understand they're by a very famous artist.
This is by Munir al-Sha'rani, who is also Syrian. He studied Arabic writing ages ago. And he used to be a guy who would design the cover of your books or magazines. But then he moved on late in his life to do this kind of writing.
I mean, they're just gorgeous in their simplicity and elegance.
He's really, really good at what he's doing. He doesn't do anything. Those are all phrases.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what they meant. Could you translate this one?
There's one of them in here. You could read it, for example.
Will rest on the magnitude of those who will it.
Yeah, that's what it means exactly in there.
Because you could read that, right?
I could read it, yes, but not everybody could. You really have to know where to start, because it is an art. It is not just somebody sitting down and trying to write in Arabic. So you might start from the top, you might start from the bottom, you might start, you know, sideways. It depends how the artist really decided how this is going to look.
So it's not literal.
Well, it is definitely, but it's you just have to know where you start. It is not typical that we start from the right to the left.
Right.
But sometimes this artist decided, for example, in this particular instance, is to read from the top to the right to the left. So he started from the top, going to the right, and then you end up in the left. Some other ones in here in the restaurant, he decides, for example, that you start reading from the bottom to the top. It depends on the design of what he's trying to say.
So if you want to spend the evening confused, you can try and do that. I'm pleased to say that I hope the menu for the evening is in English, and it starts from the top right, top left, and goes to the bottom right.
Yeah, it's. I think his main objective here is for the sentence to look really beautiful.
Oh, there is a design. No question. I love this one over here. I don't know what that says, but it's beautiful.
Yeah, he said, and there he says, hearts don't hear except from the heart.
Beautiful. Well, this is certainly an interesting experience. I wouldn't expect to have anything quite so sophisticated in London, actually.
There are very good other Lebanese restaurants in here as well. I can't comment on the decor or what they have on their walls, but I think they are quite good, sophisticated other restaurants in here.
But Mohammed, I like you a lot.
Thank you very
He's
much.
So calm, and you engender confidence. I could hardly wait to taste your kitchen.
We're looking forward to a wonderful evening here. Thank you so
Absolutely.
Much for talking to us.
A pleasure.
Well, you know, I better say, talk faster, you're going to cut me off again.
No, I'm not going to cut you off
I wanted to mention the fact that this was the second massive meal for the day, and it was supposed to be little bites. That's all, just little bites to sample the menu. And the next thing I know, there are 15 plates on the table. And I thought, boy, this is interesting. We have to sample 15 different things. And then the guy takes them away and says, well, are you ready for your main course? Now, my favorite thing is, I couldn't list all the things we had. There was, you know, one of just about everything, but they were unusual. They were very, very sophisticated in the spicing, particularly. The potatoes were fabulous, and I love that preserved beef. I mean,
You love the dried beef. Now,
yeah.
Did we have dessert or did we turn it away? I don't even remember.
No, you had dessert.
I had dessert.
I refused. I just couldn't.
What a soldier I am.
Yes. It was very good, though, actually.
Mohammed was, shall we say, modest enough to say that there are other Lebanese restaurants in the city, but I wouldn't look any further if you're in the mood for Middle Eastern food. This is a place to head to. It's also an interesting neighborhood, so it's a place that you should definitely include and take
As
a lot.
As I said, it's really. I mean, I've had a lot of Middle Eastern food. I mean, I even owned a Greek restaurant, but let me tell you, it's just it's hard to find cooks and chefs that know the old-style, traditional, very richly seasoned food that his kitchen crew.
So what's the recommendation? Get a lot of friends together and go.
Yes, he says the best deal is at least 8 people.
Yeah, well, he said that in the interview. So we just had to eat enough for 8, and we did our very best. And Mohammed, we thank you. And they say time flies when you're having fun, and it certainly has. So instead of having 4 interviews in today's program, we're going to stop there because we're at the magic hour, and we'll save Gioconda Dining Room until next week together with some old friends, and we'll look forward to talking to you then. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.